In the last several weeks, Russia has really begun targeting Ukraine's energy infrastructure. Are we running out of our air defense capabilities?
Ukraine is simply lacking interceptors. I mean, this has always been a bottleneck. Russia is producing missiles on a war economy, and the West is scaling up production, but is nowhere near where it should be. So I think it wouldn't be smart for Ukraine right now to focus on building up its own air defense systems. I think the opportunity costs for that would be too great.
Does Ukraine have any other options when it comes to air defense? Hi, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Ukraine, a show where the newsroom of the Kyiv Independent explains Ukraine's biggest events in just under 30 minutes. I'm your host, Anastasia Lopatina. Today, we're talking about Russia's recently intensified attacks against Ukraine's energy infrastructure and what challenges that poses to Ukraine's air defense. I'm joined by Fabian Hoffman, a doctoral research fellow at the University of Oslo, who focuses on defense, missile technology, and nuclear strategy. Mr. Hoffman, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
But before we get into the interview, I'll remind you guys really quickly to please subscribe to The Kyiv Independent wherever you're listening to this show, whether that's on YouTube or on audio platforms. Leave reviews, like our content, leave comments. It only takes a second for you, but really helps us because your comments and your feedback is what helps YouTube algorithms promote the show so more people will stay informed about the war in Ukraine. So on March 25th, just several days ago, Russia attacked Ukraine with its newest missile called Tsirkon. And it's reportedly only the second time that Russia has ever used this missile. The first time was in Ukraine just over a month ago in February. So could you just start by telling us, how is this missile, Tsirkon, different from other missiles that Russia has used in Ukraine in the past? Does it present some sort of unique challenge?
Yeah, so if we go back to before the war, Tsirkon was one of those hypersonic weapon systems that are really hyped up by Putin and by Russia, together especially with Kinzhal and a number of other new missile systems, right, that are really supposed to skew the balance of power in favor of Russia. Now we actually have our first insights into what is Tsirkon after we could look at the wreckages that were retrieved and analyzed. After all, similar with previous hyped up Russian weapon systems, it's not that special. That doesn't, of course, mean it does not represent a challenge. So what Tsirkon essentially is, it's a very fast cruise missile that approaches from a high altitude and then goes into a shallow dive. So it's maybe in terms of its trajectory, it's a bit more comparable to a ballistic missile that goes really high up and then comes down compared to a subsonic cruise missile like the Kalibr or the KH-101s, which have been used at really large scale by Russia, which approach their target usually at a really low altitude and also with subsonic speeds. This specific trajectory, so coming in from a relatively high altitude and with really high speed, and what I've seen also, and this is not 100% confirmed, but for example, Tsirkon also has a second rocket booster apparently that once again, provides an additional amount of velocity really at the terminal stage of the flight. And overall, this capability profile, it means that it's quite challenging to intercept these weapon systems, and not every missile defense system in Ukraine's arsenal will be able to deal with it. So, for example, IRIS-T or NASAMS are really optimized to engage subsonic cruise missile threats like Kalibr, like KH-101 or Shahed drones, for example. But they would, for example, struggle or not be capable of dealing with the Tsirkon. And so what you need for that is something more like a Patriot, which we have seen, right? PAC-3 MSE interceptors have apparently been able to shoot down Tsirkon. So definitely something you can deal with, but it represents somewhat of a challenge.
You said that there are certain systems in Ukraine's air defense arsenal that, can shoot down the Tsirkon, but some can't. So I wonder, is that maybe a reason why Russia often attacks Ukraine with, a whole array of different missiles and drones all at once, as to make it really difficult for the air defense to engage all of these different missiles and drones?
Yes, that's exactly the reason behind it. So what from a Russian perspective, what you want to do, you want to overwhelm Kiev's and Ukraine's missile defense system in general by presenting what we call a multi-vectorial time coordinated attack, so that your missile systems and drone systems come in from different angles, different trajectories, different speeds, but ideally, right, within the same, in a relatively short period of time, to really make it difficult for those missile defense assets on the ground to allocate interceptors, to prioritize targets, in the hope that, right, something will slip through.
Let's shift to talking about more of the recent attacks. And in the last several weeks, Russia has really begun targeting Ukraine's energy infrastructure, which is a bit strange because everybody was expecting, you know, a blackout or Russia's intense attacks against power infrastructure in Ukraine during winter, because that makes sense if you're Russia. They're trying to cause maximum damage when temperatures are low and people really rely on that power as much as possible. But not much actually happened, and Russia targeted military sites more. There was no blackout. But now, just in a matter of days, actually, Russia destroyed pretty much half of the energy generating capacity of one of Ukraine's largest power providers. And experts are saying that it may take several years even to repair the damage, which is, of course, pretty significant. So is Russia shifting strategy? Why is it attacking the energy infrastructure now?
Yeah, obviously, I mean, we can only speculate about the specific reasons and the timing. You're correct that actually during winter, Russia shifted its approach somewhat to targeting. So instead of targeting the energy infrastructure, which we saw on the previous winter at really large scale, they went more after military targets and then also industrial targets, right? So it's basically moving from a, you could call it a counter-population or punishment approach, which is really about undermining the morale of the civilian population, more towards a counter-industry and strategic interdiction approach, which is all about undermining the supply of critical materials, right? Making sure that Ukrainian equipment is interdicted in the deployment and pre-deployment stage. And from a military perspective, this is actually quite a bit more effective, and in that sense, also a bit more worrisome. And then it's correct that over the last few days and weeks, we've actually seen Russia shift once again more towards engaging critical infrastructure targets, especially electricity. And I mean, to some extent, that fits in within the previous, because of course, electricity, energy, that's also crucial resources for industrial production, for the military in general. And then you know, also, it imposes just an opportunity cost, because the money, the time, the manpower invested into repairing this damage, of course, also could have gone into the general war effort, or more specifically into aspects where it is perhaps more critically needed. So in that sense, it can also effectively contribute to what Russia is doing.
Generally speaking, it seems like Ukraine's air defense hasn't really been doing as well as recently, and hasn't been as successful at shooting down Russian missiles. Does that speak to some issues in Ukrainian operations, or are the Russians changing tactics for the better?
That's a really good question. I would say in general, right, the thing with missile defense in Ukraine is that it's been actually a lot more effective than a lot of analysts would have expected previous to the war, myself included. But if you compare it to the track record, for example, if you compare Ukrainian patriots around Kiev to the track record of Saudi Arabian patriots that, you know, really struggled with intercepting ballistic missile threats that came from Yemen, from the Houthis, it's actually quite surprising how effective it has been over the last year or so. This being said, it is correct that it appears that Ukraine has faced more issues in recent weeks than before. In general, Ukraine never received enough air defense assets to cover the whole country. So Ukraine always had to prioritize and shield specific geographical areas and installations more than others. So what we What we've seen, for example, is that generally speaking, the missile defense shield around Kyiv has been very effective, including in dealing with these multi-vectorial time-coordinated attacks where you suddenly have drones, cruise missiles, and ballistic missiles all arriving at the same time. And we've seen repeatedly, right, that Ukraine has managed to intercept 100% of these incoming threats and none slip through. And so again, right, without direct insights into what essentially is military intelligence, we can't say for sure what's happening. We can, of course, speculate about the reasons. So it might be, for one thing, that Ukraine is simply lacking interceptors. I mean, this has always been a bottleneck. And Ukraine has, you know, asking for months now for more interceptors from Western states. And if they do not keep coming at the speed that they should, I mean, especially with US aid not arriving in Ukraine, then, you know, it could also just be that, sure, you have the launcher capabilities, but you simply do not have the interceptors available to shoot at all the incoming targets. But, you know, generally speaking, doctrine also says that, for example, if you're dealing with a short-range ballistic missile, that you should fire three interceptors at it. This is what US doctrine says. This is what Saudi Arabia does in you know, when dealing with Houthi ballistic missiles. But now if you're, you know, if you know you basically have a very limited supply of Patriot interceptors, if you're Ukraine, you know, you might say, okay, look, best I can do is fire one or two interceptors. And that, of course, then also lowers your the kill probability that you have in terms of intercepting the missile. So I could imagine that this is one reason. It's of course also possible, right, that I mean, Russia has been adapting throughout the war. They found a way to make their missile attacks somewhat more effective. I haven't seen direct insights or direct indications, you know, that would indicate that Russia, yeah, for sure has really changed something and it's better now. But it's also not something I would exclude, right? That there are things behind the scenes that we, with open source intelligence, do not necessarily have access to, that would demonstrate that Russia has taken measures to improve the survivability of its missiles.
It's kind of crazy that we're talking about this now because, as I said, there was an air raid and now people are reporting that allegedly there might be ballistic missiles incoming from the north. So we're going to see how that goes. So let's get into the technicalities of all of these systems. What are the different air defense systems that Ukraine has at its disposal? And just briefly, what are some of their differences and what missiles they can be working with shooting down?
Sure. So you have the most upper layer, basically, is of the missile defense network in Ukraine are longer range systems like Patriot from the United States or SAMT, which is a French-Italian system. And these systems are optimized to engage longer range threats, especially ballistic threats. So that would include Kinjal, for example, Iskander M ballistic missiles, or also higher altitude cruise missiles, right? Like also Zircon, or for example, also the KH-22, which is an anti-ship cruise missile, which has been repurposed for land attack roles and which we've also seen being used by Russia in, over the last few months, repeatedly. And so these are, right, these are missile defense systems that you usually want to use to engage or that are optimized to engage high altitude threats. So high altitude cruise missiles and ballistic missiles that come in from high altitude. Then you have the medium layer, so to say, is basically comprised of NASAMS and IRIS-T, which is, you know, they come from Germany, IRIS-T, and then Norway American system, NASAMS. And they are really optimized to engage subsonic low-flying threats. So mainly subsonic cruise missiles like KH-101, like Caliber and Shahed drones, for example. The thing is, you can't really use these types of systems to also engage short-range ballistic missiles. That's first has to do with the radar and command and control. And second, the interceptors just do not have the range to go up to that altitude and deal with the threat effectively. And also, right, it's always a question of optimization. I mean, dealing with an incoming ballistic missile is totally different than dealing with an incoming subsonic cruise missile. And your seekers inside the interceptor, they then are based, right, or they work with different algorithms, essentially, that help them guide the interceptor to the target. And these algorithms are then, you know, optimized for one threat or another.
Mm-hmm.
And then you also, of course, have a shorter range spectrum and point missile defense systems. And that, you know, is the German Gepard that was delivered. That is, of course, also a bunch of Soviet legacy systems or Russian systems that Ukraine already had in its arsenal, like Buk, for example. These are really done right. You want to have them closer to certain installations. Their engagement radius is perhaps like 10 to 30 kilometers at max.
So I assume those systems are used mostly near the front line?
They could be used near the front line. Or, you know, you could also put them, for example, next to an important infrastructure facility related to electricity production, right? So really as a point defense system. And, you know, speaking about point defense, I mean, in the end, you also have things like manheads, right? Or simply guns with which you can shoot at incoming missile systems. That might work for cruise missiles and drones. And we actually, you know, I've seen that quite successfully. Ukrainian soldiers taking down cruise missiles and drones with manheads or, you know, with their guns or air defense guns, these sort of things. But that's really like your last measure before impact, basically.
After the Russian attack, during which Russia used the Tsirkon, Ukrainian officials started to really push this message that Ukraine needs more air defense systems. Just yesterday, I think Zelensky said that he doesn't understand why the Patriots don't cover the skies of cities like Kharkiv or Sumy. Those are some of the cities that get hammered by Russian attacks literally every single day. Of course, there is some nuance to that statement, mainly being that Patriots, as you've mentioned, can't really shoot every single thing down and they're not suitable maybe for some of those cities. Nevertheless, this messaging is a bit of a shift in rhetoric, I think, because our government used to focus mainly on offensive weapons most of the time. But then U.S. officials also told the press that unless Congress passes a new aid bill that everyone has been talking about for months, the situation with ammunition, including for air defense, can get catastrophic essentially this spring. And it's already the end of March. So all of this taking into account, is Ukraine in real trouble here? Are we running out of our air defense capabilities?
Yeah, I mean, in the end, Russia is producing missiles on a war economy, and the West is scaling up production, but is nowhere near where it should be or where it has to be in order to deal with these types of missile threats effectively. And that relates to both launchers, radars, and then, of course, also interceptor ammunition. And yeah, so in that sense, right, the few Patriot batteries and launchers that have been provided by Germany, the Netherlands, in Spain, also the United States, they're then enough to cover, in theory, a few cities, especially Kiev. But yeah, there's just simply not enough for Kharkiv and other big population centers that would desperately need protection from these types of missile defense systems. And then it also goes back, of course, to just interceptors, just being a short commodity. And again, the United States right now is the only country that produces Patriot interceptors. Germany is building a production line with MBDA Germany. So it's this licensed production for Patriot PAC-2 interceptors, but it's going to take until 2026, until this production line comes online. And until then, the United States is the sole provider of new Patriot interceptors. And if they're not delivering, then the only other option is to look into the arsenals of Western states that might be willing to supply Ukraine. But here we also see, right, these arsenals are empty. I mean, Germany never had a large arsenal to begin with, simply because it never took, you know, military threats seriously over the last 2 to 3 decades. But that's also true for the Netherlands and true for a lot of other countries that deploy Patriot. there's just not enough to go around and to supply to Ukraine. So yeah, it's a very dangerous situation.
This was actually going to be my next question, that it seems like Zelensky's question about why aren't there more Patriots? Why isn't there more air defense? It seems entirely valid because in my mind, at least, air defense systems are defensive, right? So it seems like the easiest weapons delivery possible to sell, politically speaking.
Yeah.
To sell to your parliament, to sell to your people. It's not a HIMARS or it's not a Taurus, you know? So why isn't Ukraine getting more of the systems? Is it just because, as you've said, Europe itself and America, they're just running low on them? They never produced as many?
Yeah, it's certainly that. Another factor for sure is that while, you know, for a state like Germany, it would be politically rather easy to justify spending on these type of weapon systems. In the end, interceptors and missile defense, these things are really, really expensive. You know, often the interceptor is more expensive than the missile system itself. Not always, but you know, quite a few times, so quite often, I would say. And then, as I said earlier, often you ideally also want to shoot two or three against the incoming targets, especially when you deal with ballistic missile threats, just to make sure that you get a really high probability of intercept. And then, you know, the financial costs of missile defense very soon increase very much. And, you know, that's always been the case. And I think that's always why it's been, while it may have been a politically easy sell, it was always a financially tough one. And that's especially, right, in the West. And I think that's maybe a bit underappreciated. That's also where the West has to critically look back at its own policies.
In contrast to the struggles that Ukraine is facing, can you tell us a bit about the state of Russian missile production? I think you've alluded a little bit to the fact that, of course, the Russian economy has fully transformed itself into being a war economy. So do we know how many missiles does Russia have, or what's the rate at which they're producing it? And like, what does that say about the threat that poses to Ukraine?
Yeah, so obviously I can only talk about what I've seen from open sources. So right, like classified insights might look totally different. Mm-hmm. But it appears that Russia has produced around 50 to 60 Bruce missiles per month prior to the war, and around 5 to 10 short-range ballistic missiles. Mm-hmm. And then after the war, once sanctions kicked in, and in the beginning when they were rather effective, this production dropped. And then after Russia was able to deal better with the sanctions, production increased again, and it appears now that it has surpassed actually initial production compared to the beginning of the war. So there are various estimates out there. I mean, I've seen that, you know, for example, Russia is right now producing around 100 cruise missiles per month and 20 to 30 short-range ballistic missiles. I can't, you know, without better insights, I think you have to be really careful with these estimates. But I would say, as a ballpark number, that seems rather realistic. And I think it is also, unfortunately, realistic to assume that Russia has been able to now, or to outscale its production compared to the beginning, or where it has been in the beginning of the war. In terms of its missile arsenal, that's of course fluctuating, right? I think Russia makes an effort once in a while to really build up that arsenal and then to use it at a larger scale, because it knows that, you know, if the missile systems fly in piecemeal, it will have a much lower probability of having success with its missile attacks. So there is a reason, there's a value for them in building up large missile arsenals and then using them at once for over a relatively short period of time, something that they might be doing right now. But in the end, of course, right, they will always retain a reserve stockpile. That's something they have to do simply because, I mean, also for Russia, it's not completely, they can't completely exclude the fact that NATO might at one point be directly involved in the conflict, or that it might escalate. So you want to retain a reserve stockpile. I would assume of a couple hundred cruise missiles, and ideally maybe 100 to 200 short range ballistic missiles at the minimum. So it's also right, like this idea, Russia will, because of these reasons, they will never completely run out of missiles, because they can A, reproduce, and B, they will always retain a missile reserve that they just need for different contingencies.
Apart from pleading for more help from the West and hoping that the chaos in Congress fixes itself and there is more help from European nations, does Ukraine have any other options when it comes to air defense? Like, can Ukraine produce its own air defense systems or produce anything else that might help in that domain?
I think it wouldn't be smart for Ukraine right now to focus on building up its own air defense systems. I think the opportunity costs for that would be too great. Meaning, right, like the financial investment, the manpower investment would just be that I think that would not be justifiable considering all the other things that Ukraine needs to deal with. I think the best thing that Ukraine can do in terms of investing in its missile defense is actually building up its own offensive strike capability. Get to the point where you can engage those launcher facilities inside Russia. And Ukraine has a couple of missile programs ongoing. Neptune, which is an anti-ship cruise missile, but has been also repurposed for has been used for land attack purposes. There's the Korshun, I'm probably pronouncing it completely wrong, but which is a land attack cruise missile, which is somewhat based on the Neptune and also on a, say, Soviet legacy product, which has a much longer range, which could be used effectively in that role, right, as a counter-strike role. And then, of course, you also have the Sapsan, which is a short-range ballistic missile, which would also be very effective in terms of being used to engage Russian launcher facilities, both maritime and aircraft facilities, right, that enable these types of missile attacks. And I think this is really, right, this should be a priority for Ukraine to work on that. As I see it right now, Ukraine has prioritized in recent months its long-range drone production, which, you mm-hmm. know, I mean, we see how effective it is. So I'm not saying this was a right. wrong decision. But I would say that Ukraine should also make an effort to advance these cruise and ballistic missile programs because they can do substantial damage to Russia and they might be a more effective way of dealing with these types of missile attacks, so intercepting them when they're still on the ground rather than up in the air.
We're now going to be moving to the community question of today's episode. I remind you guys to please go to communitydependent.com/membership to subscribe to the Community Independent. It only takes a second. There are several tiers of support, including a one-time donation or a monthly membership in our community. And you get really cool perks like access to exclusive discussions with editors and journalists. And also our favorite perk, you get to send us in questions before every single episode of the podcast. And we try to incorporate as many of them as we can throughout the episode. So this time, the community member is wondering, what impact will the arrival of F-16's fighter jets make in terms of Ukraine's air defense capability?
I think in terms of right, like real missile defense, I think F-16s will not be able to intercept Russian strategic bombers that deploy cruise missiles. I think right, they still launch them too far inside Russia. And the Ukrainian F-16s, they don't have the range or the equipment to deal with this kind of threat. However, I think where F-16s are actually, where they hopefully can be quite effective, is in terms of dealing with this new threat of Russian glide bombs, which has been a huge issue, especially for troops deployed on the front line. And, you know, now, unfortunately, Russia has also started to use them against civilian targets at a greater scale. So this is really, I think, quite a threatening situation right now for Ukraine. And hopefully F-16s, they can deal with those Russian fighter jets that deploy these glide bombs because they have to fly closer to the front line. And if F-16s are equipped with the right radars and the right weapon systems, they certainly have the range to shoot down these incoming Russian fighter jets before they can deploy their glide bombs.
Well, Mr. Hoffman, thank you so much. It was very interesting to listen to you.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
You can find our show on YouTube and all audio platforms every Saturday. If you like this episode, please subscribe to The Kim Independent wherever you're listening to the show and support us by going to kimindependent.com/membership. Also, support us by following Kim Independent on social media, on Facebook, X, and Instagram. We'll be back next week. Thank you for listening.